Well, I'm no expert, but I'd be willing to place a small wager on the idea that our mild winter means more bugs for Wisconsin this spring and summer. Hi, I'm John Munson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. With me is one of our bug experts, P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. P.J. holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the University of Wisconsin. Remember, you can join the conversation, as some people already have, by calling 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or by posting on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. So, P.J., am I right? Will we be seeing more insects this year?
Well, it's certainly possible. One of the biggest thing that plays into insect populations turns out to be the spring weather patterns. So I think the milder winter certainly gave certain insects a better chance of making it through the winter compared to the winter we had a couple years ago where it was brutally cold, although it turns out that a lot of our insects are adapted to the winter months, and they either go through the winter as an egg or a pupal stage, which are pretty resilient life stages, and so they can make it through the winter. Or some other insects like box elder bugs, Asian lady beetles, which have been doing really well lately, they actually find sheltered locations, and that's why they end up sneaking indoors. So it's a little early to tell, although I suspect with the milder winter, wouldn't surprise me if we had more insects out this year.
Well, I've always wondered where the bugs actually go and how they do survive in this harsh climate.
Yeah, and so it all depends on the species that we're talking about. And in Wisconsin, we've got easily 20,000 species of insects, maybe even up to 25,000. So there's a lot of insects here. Each one is different. As I mentioned, some will spend the winter months as eggs, and eggs are a pretty resilient life stage. Others may spend the winter as juveniles, such as larvae, caterpillars for some insects, or a pupal stage. Some spend the winter as adults, and they may find sheltered locations. And we actually even have some butterflies that do that, for example. They'll find a hollow log. And so I've had some reports so far this year of folks seeing butterflies out and active last week because it's some of these species that just spend the winter as adults. So each species is a little bit different in terms of their habits.
So overall, the impact of our mild winter on the insect population, there hasn't been a lot of effect from the mild winter. We really need to wait for what we have this spring. And in some parts of the state, it's pretty wintry this morning. But we really need to wait for the spring to figure out what's really going on.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, overall, I've had quite a few reports of insects being active. And if you think about the temperatures we had last week, we were up in the 60s some days, maybe even close to 70s at certain spots in the state. Most insects, they need a temperature of about 50 degrees or higher until they'll become active. And so this week, we're not going to see much insect activity because it's down in the 40s, but I think we're going to have to wait until later in the spring to really tell for sure, are we having more insect activity this year?
All right, and what about the outlook for mosquitoes this year? That's something that's certainly on the minds of everyone who likes to be out of doors, particularly in the evening.
Sure. Yeah, and with things in the news like Zika virus, I mean, mosquitoes are really on the top of everyone's minds at the moment. Now, for mosquitoes, it turns out we have at least 50 or more species of mosquitoes, and some recent work here at UW figures out we may even have over 60 species of mosquitoes in the state. Each of those species has slightly different habits. There are certain mosquitoes that spend the winter as adults, and so it's even possible you could have gotten some mosquito bites last week, even though it's very, very early in the season. There are other ones that are more of our nuisance mosquitoes that we attribute to melting snow and in particular the spring rains. And when we get flooded areas out in the woods in April and May, that's what often really gets the mosquitoes really going. So at this point, it's almost impossible to predict exactly what the mosquitoes will be like. We have to wait and see what the spring rains do for us.
Well, we had a call from Chris in Wisconsin Dells who wanted to warn people that deer ticks are out and mating already. She took 20 off her cat yesterday. What's the outlook for the tick population?
So Ticks, we've noticed the last few years in the state, the tick populations have been doing really well, especially for things like deer ticks, which we can essentially find statewide at this point. And with deer ticks, they can be active at pretty low temperatures. Anytime it's above freezing and there's no snow on the ground, there's a potential for ticks such as deer ticks to be active. I know I've had several reports come in already. So it is that time of year that both people and pets need to be taking precautions to deal with ticks, prevent issues with them, and make sure that we don't come down with something such as Lyme disease.
Are we seeing an increase in the numbers of ticks over time, say over the last decade, or are we just paying more attention to them now because of Lyme disease?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, actually. And if you think of something like the deer tick, there's a rather interesting story with that species in the state because historically, the deer tick was more of a southern species, places like Texas and the like. We didn't find our first deer tick in Wisconsin until about the late 60s, early 70s. So to go from essentially no deer ticks to having deer ticks spread across the state, that's really a pretty emerging health threat in the span of about 4 or 5 decades or so.
Yeah, and it is a major concern. 800-642-1234. Chris in Wisconsin Dells, thanks for calling in with that warning about the ticks. Let's take a call. Let's go to Hebron, Illinois, and hear from Phil. Phil, good morning.
Good morning, you guys. I have a quick question for you. I've got an area that's surrounded by a natural area, and I've been over the years seeing an increasing number of butterflies, tiger swallowtails, giant swallowtails, and monarchs. And last year, what was interesting is it would be common for me to see 8 and 10 monarchs, but I was seeing 8 and 10 viceroys also. Never seen a viceroy in my life, and my question is, does that tell me that I'm going to see more viceroys, or does that population not go in sync with the monarchs?
So I've never heard anything with the viceroys necessarily being in sync with the monarchs. When it comes to butterflies in general, every year is kind of a different story. There's a lot of factors at play there, such as spring weather, parasites, bacteria, things like that. Some years you just got great weather, we get a good butterfly year, and other years we just don't see a whole lot of butterflies. So it's really hard to kind of tell and predict what the butterflies are going to do year to year for a certain species. Now, for something like the monarch, we do monitor that species because it's in the news a lot, and their populations have been struggling a bit. Overall, I suspect we may be having a pretty good monarch year. We can expect to have a pretty good one. In terms of the reports of sightings I had coming in last year, I got an awful lot of them. And also, there are scientists that survey the overwintering population down in Mexico, and they get an indicator of how their numbers are doing down there. Now, some news came out about 2 or 3 weeks ago that it was from the scientists that surveyed the overwintering populations, and what they do is they estimate the amount of area that has these monarch butterflies rather than going out and counting individuals because there's so many millions of butterflies there. But they noticed this year the amount of area that had monarch butterflies overwintering in it was about 3 to 4 times higher than what it was last year. So it means we got a lot more monarchs, which is a good sign. But there's a little bit of scary news because just about a week ago, there was actually this historic winter storm. The jet stream dipped way down into Mexico, ended up dumping snow on the monarchs. And when that happens, there's always a potential it could kill off some of the isolated populations in these mountainous areas of Mexico. And so we still don't know the overall effects that that winter storm would have. Some good news I just checked recently. It sounds like those monarchs may have made it through that winter storm because they're still clinging to the trees. Typically, if those monarchs freeze to death from a freak snowstorm like that, they tend to fall off the trees. So hopefully they all make it through that winter storm, and I think we may have a pretty good monarch year up here in the Midwest.
Well, and that brings up another question that I had, because our spring weather is so variable, and you mentioned that last week when it got warmer, some insects were out. Okay, so what happens? These insects come out when it's really nice, and then all of a sudden the weather changes again, and it might get really cold, we might get a lot of snow. How does that affect, are the populations then vulnerable to those kinds of changes if they come out too early?
Well, there's always a potential for that. It all depends, again, on the species. And the insects that we were seeing active last week, those would have been, for the most part, the insects that spent the winter as adults. And so they're pretty good at hunkering down, finding sheltered locations, and they are kind of used to the cooler temps. So I'm not expecting it to have a huge impact on them, that is the cooler weather this week. Now, if we had a different scenario, theoretically, let's say it was early May, and a lot of insects had hatched out of eggs in a situation like that, and then we got a really cold frost. Well, in that case, then I'd say there's a potential that it could kill off a lot of insects. But also in that case, I'd be worried about a lot of our plants, too, just killing off the early season buds and leaves and the like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I always know it's actually spring when I see the first housefly. Forget about the robins. I'm looking for the... When I hear that housefly banging against the window from the inside, I know that it's really spring. We have a comment from Lynn on Facebook who asks PJ to talk about Texas red star ticks and how can she tell these from other ticks?
Well, so I'll admit I have not heard of a Texas red star tick before. What I wonder is if Lynn may be referring to a lone star tick. Which happens to be associated with places like Texas, although we have been spotting them up here in Wisconsin for several years now, maybe a handful of reports each year. That one is going to be fairly similar in size to our wood or American dog tick, except the females are all dark in color, and they have a very distinct pale kind of cream color or yellowish dot right in the middle of their backside, which makes them pretty easy to identify.
Okay, 800-642-1234, the number to call. We've got callers who want to get in on the program, and we'll continue that. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more with P.J. Leash about insects in the spring in Wisconsin. We've talked about ticks. We've talked about monarch butterflies. We'll talk about what other insects are active right now and which ones will be emerging next. We'll talk about things like box alder bugs and all sorts of things. If it's an insect, we'll talk about it here on the Larry Mueller Show. P.J. Leash, my guest, and you can join us on the phone at 800-642-1234. Find the Larry Mueller Show on Facebook and leave a picture of a bug that you found recently, and P.J. will try and identify it for us. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's the Larry Mueller Show. My guest is Patrick J. Leash. P.J. Leash is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he's here to talk about bugs we have in Wisconsin and what we're going to see this spring, what effect our mild winter has had on our insect population, and take your questions about bugs that you found here in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. PJ, let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Castle Rock next. Mike is with us. Mike, welcome to the Larry Mueller Program.
Good morning. I live in the deep country, and I've noticed over the years, it used to be insects that would get splattered on the windshield of cars, including mine. And I didn't clean the windshield at all last year, and I don't think I did the year before that either. And I noticed when I put the lights out on my deck here in the evening, there used to be moths that would fly around the lights. Those are pretty much gone also. And I personally think that the insect population, at least in where I live, is collapsing. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. And I don't know if that has anything to do with beehives also, but something is going on here.
Mike, thanks for the call. PG, are we seeing drops in populations of some types of bugs?
Well, so this is a really good question, and we could probably talk about this for quite a while. Overall, it's really hard to tell, just because you'd have to talk about each species individually. Now, if we look at the situation as a whole, in terms of land use over the last several decades, we have a lot more urbanization, intensive farming, and so the landscape and insect habitat has changed quite a bit. And so that could potentially be at play a little bit, that the insects are just getting these smaller bits of habitat in the state as a whole. Now, another thing that could be playing in, especially when it comes to the lights, and insects coming to lights is an interesting phenomenon. You could have your porch light on or put out an insect light trap every night for a couple of years in a row, and you'll get a different group of insects that will show up almost every night. And so it's really fascinating. But in terms of some of the light technology, insects can be affected by the individual wavelengths of light that are emitted by light bulbs. And so with some of the newer light technology, I wonder if the lights are designed or they're using frequencies that may be less attractive to insects. And we can actually use that as a pest control tactic in some cases, because if you've got a highly attractive light right near your building, you're of course going to draw more insects in, whereas if we use a different type of bulb, you're just not going to attract as many insects. So it could be a lot of different factors at play here, but it's really hard to tell what the overall insect situation is doing in terms of declines for some of the species that are just hard to figure out where they are and what they're doing.
So which do we know which types of lighting are more attractive or less attractive to certain types of insects? For example, a lot of people are now going to LED bulbs in their exterior lighting. Are those less attractive to certain types of insects?
Well, so that's a good question. And off the top of my head, I don't know the exact frequencies or wavelengths of light that those LED lights are emitting. I know if you look at certain lights, like UV lights in particular, entomologists will use UV lights as an insect attractant for traps, because insects, their vision is shifted a little bit more towards the ultraviolet and UV range. So they can see different wavelengths than we do. Some other really attractive one, mercury vapor lamps, for example, are highly attractive to insects, whereas something like a sodium vapor lamp has very specific wavelengths in the yellow range, those ones aren't as attracted. So each bulb is a little bit different. And also, if you use a light bulb, over time, the wavelengths can perhaps change a little bit in some cases, and that can also alter the attractiveness. But in terms of the LED lights, I just don't know the exact wavelengths off the top of my head, so I can't tell you how attractive those would be. I suspect they'd be decent at attracting insects, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go to Neshkoro next and hear from Joanne. Joanne, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, well, there seems to be another breed of ticks, little tiny black ones. They're about the size of deer ticks, but they're completely black. And the back of my yard is just covered with them. And I had a friend who was bitten by one, and it just developed a horrendous sore from that. So something else to look out for, I guess.
Thanks, Joanne. PJ, do we have a new species of tick on the block?
Well, nothing that I'm aware of. I wonder if it may simply be one of the juvenile stages of some of our ticks, because the color patterns of juvenile ticks can be somewhat different than the adult ticks. And even if you looked at species like the deer tick, the females are larger and they have some reddish on the body, whereas the males tend to be smaller and almost entirely dark brownish, almost blackish in color. So I suspect It's probably one of our native species of ticks, or one of our common ones that we've got around here, and it may just be a different life stage, or it may be one of the sexes of the ticks.
Joanne, if you can get a picture of one of these black ticks, post it on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and PJ can take a look at it and give you maybe a little more specific opinion. Thanks for the call. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We have Gordon in Augusta who reached out to us to say he took a swollen wood tick off his dog, but his question is, where do ticks go in the winter?
So with ticks and their winter behavior, an awful lot of them are just going to get down to the ground level and kind of hide down amongst the leaf litter. And if you think about that, that's a fairly sheltered location because you've got leaves on top of you. That will help provide some insulation and buffering from the cold temperatures, and also the snow falls on top of that, which is why once the snow melts out in the spring, spring, those ticks can be pretty active and ready to go in a lot of cases. Now, there are actually some other tick species, such as the winter tick, that can spend the winter months actually on a host, such as large mammals, such as moose, up in northern Minnesota and places like that. So each tick species, a little bit different, but a lot of them are going to spend the winter down amongst leaf litter on the ground.
And that brings up another question. Are there natural predators that feed on ticks at all or not?
Well, for the most part, not a whole lot of things that I can think of off the top of my head will feed on ticks. There are some mammals that may be pretty good at grooming themselves and kind of doing self-tick removal. But in terms of insect predators and parasites and things like that, I just can't think of anything off the top of my head that would cause significant mortality or have a significant effect on tick populations.
And we had another caller who couldn't stay on who had a tick question. She wants to know how she should dispose of dead ticks. She read that they can still be dangerous.
Well, I mean, in general, when I take ticks off, I just put them in the trash can. In theory, if you had just killed a deer tick that was infected with the Lyme disease, you know, there's a possibility there that it still has something in it. But in terms of that microorganism getting into your bloodstream or into a pet, it just isn't likely. So simply tossing them in the garbage can, I think, is perfectly fine.
Okay. Let's go to Dunn and take a call from John next. John, hello. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. I have a question about my oak trees. I have some trimming that needs to get done. Is it too late to do that now? Are the bugs that infect those oak trees' wounds, are they out already?
Ah, so that's a really good question. In the situation that we're talking about, there are some beetles that we call picnic beetles, kind of small black and yellowish spotted beetles. And what they can do is carry around fungal spores from a very serious disease of oaks called oak wilt. And in the state, we typically tell folks from a certain point in the spring until a certain point in fall, basically during the warmer months, don't prune your trees. Because what will happen is if you prune your tree and it doesn't have oak wilt, these beetles can fly in, be attracted to the dripping sap, and potentially give that oak wilt pathogen or disease to your tree. Now, what typically happens is those insects, those little picnic beetles, are going to be pretty inactive. But once it gets to about 50 degrees, they can start being active and potentially flying around. Now, I haven't had any specific reports of them being spotted or being active yet in the state. However, with the weather we've had the last week, it wouldn't surprise me if they could be out and active. With the cooler temperatures this week, I wouldn't expect them to be active because it's only in the 40s. If I had some oak pruning that I really needed to get done and just couldn't avoid it, I would probably go out and try some type of pruning paint afterwards to make sure that I seal over that wound, because I think with the temperatures we've had, that those insects, and some can spend the winter as adults, as soon as it gets to about 50 degrees or greater, there's a chance they could be out and about.
John, thanks for that question. Let's hear next from Dennis in Wautoma. Dennis, hello.
Hi. I am wondering if there is anything that is environmentally friendly we could use in the spring to help reduce the number of ticks and mosquitoes in the summer.
And can we do something on our property to reduce ticks and mosquitoes that would be environmentally friendly? PJ, what do you think?
Sure. So there's actually a number of things that we can do without having to use pesticides, simply in terms of modifying the environment. Let's talk about ticks first. Ticks tend to prefer kind of grassy, weedy areas, but also wooded areas, especially where you've got a lot of shrubs, perhaps honeysuckle, brambles, things like that, where you may have small mammal populations. If we keep our yard itself relatively free of tall grassy areas, for example, if we just have a lawn, ticks don't tend to like those areas very well because it's too open. We get a lot more sunlight that penetrates down into turf grass areas. It's a little hotter, littered, little bit drier compared to weedy areas or wooded areas. So one thing we can do is simply manage the vegetation in our yard. That can help with ticks. Now, One thing we can consider, if you know that you have a lot of ticks in your yard and they're coming from that wooded area at the edge of your yard or that grassy area, we could consider applying an insecticide right along the edge where the ticks may be moving from the weedy area into a turf grass area. Otherwise, as I said, we manage the vegetation, and also just taking precautions for people and pets, making sure your animals, dogs or cats or any other outdoor animals, have a preventative flea and tick treatment from their veterinarian, but also for people, doing tick checks, using repellents. And so if we want to, we can really kind of deal with the tick situation without having to spray a pesticide at all, just by modifying the environment. And a very similar thing with mosquitoes. If you think about mosquitoes, they need water to go through their development and survive. And so if we take a look at our yard, any standing body of water could potentially be a mosquito breeding zone. So if you've got, it could even be something like a kid's bucket in a sandbox, that if it fills up with water and it's going to sit there for a while. And during the summer months, and it's warm enough, mosquitoes might only need about 10 days or so, a week and a half, to go through that development cycle from egg to adults. Depends on the temperature a bit. But other places around the yard where you could have standing water and potential breeding habitat, bird baths, if the water isn't changed regularly, if you had a clogged gutter where maybe there's some leaves that are kind of damming up the water a bit, that could be a potential breeding spot. Old tires, any type of catch basin that will hold water in could be a potential breeding spot. Now, in terms of spraying and fogging and things like that, when we do that in a yard, typically that is going to be a very kind of short-term solution. Because it'll kill the insects, but those materials don't last very long. If you have an event coming up, such as a wedding, then that's an option. But in terms of spraying regularly to control mosquitoes, we just don't do that, or it just doesn't seem to be worth the effort. And in some cases, there are mosquitoes that we call our nuisance mosquitoes. These are the ones that breed in flooded areas out in the woods, and they can be very strong flyers. And so you could, in theory, kill all the mosquitoes in your yard, and they could fly in or get blown in from 10 or 20 miles away. So there's only so much we can do. But again, dealing with bodies of water in our yard, making sure to eliminate as many of those as we can. Or if it's something like the bird bath, just changing the water about every week or so during the warmer months, or even more often than that. But also in terms of personal protection, long sleeves, long pants if the mosquitoes are bad, using repellents. If it's just a really bad mosquito year, maybe staying indoors during the early morning hours or evening hours, or stay in a screened porch area. Or if it's a breezy evening, we won't have to worry about mosquitoes as much. And I've even heard of folks putting in a big fan on their deck to basically blow the mosquitoes away, because mosquitoes aren't very strong flyers if there's a wind. So I think there's a lot of options we have for both ticks and mosquitoes where we don't have to use pesticides.
Mm-hmm. Putting an oscillating fan on your deck can be a pretty handy way to keep the mosquitoes down a little bit, or at least keep them away, can't it?
Mm-hmm.
800-642-1234, lines available now if you want to call. And if you get a busy signal, why don't you send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or you can post to our Facebook page, look for the Larry Mueller Show. Take a picture of a bug you'd like PJ to identify. We'll make sure that he gets a look at it and can tell you what it is. 800-642-1234. Brad in Milwaukee, you'll be next. Brad, hello.
Yeah, hello, good morning. Yeah, I just want to say I've noticed the impact of the warm winter on bugs. A couple of weeks ago at a restaurant, I saw at the base of the restaurant, I think in like plaster, masses of box elder bugs, black and orange beetles. I think that's what they are. Maybe you could help me if that's identified. But, and then in a couple of spots, hundreds of them. I just thought, wow. It only took a few. I think that weekend was maybe in the 40s. That day was in the 40s. Doesn't take much for the bugs to come out, even in winter. And then the very next day, we had our last snowstorm so far of like 2-3 inches. So,
okay. Yeah, Brad, thanks for the call. Box elder bugs are starting to emerge. They're annoying, but do they do any harm? And what about it? They come out and then it snows. How do they do?
Well, so this is one of these insects that spends the winter as adults. So last year in the fall, these guys like to sneak into cracks and crevices. It could be a crack in a foundation. They could get around a door window frame that doesn't quite seal properly, under the siding of homes. And so they will hunker down for the winter, and then as soon as it becomes warm enough, we see them active again. And so it's actually not uncommon to hear of them being active when it's a little bit cooler, perhaps, maybe down in the 40s, especially on southern or western or southwestern faces of buildings, because those parts of the buildings catch the afternoon sun. They kind of warm up this little microclimate area. And so it can be 45 degrees, a sunny day, and you'll see a side of building coated with box elder bugs. Now, overall, box elder bugs really don't do much damage. They technically feed on seeds of box elder trees, which are a type of maple, and they can also feed on perhaps some of the maple seeds, like silver maple I've heard of in the literature, but they don't seem to cause any harm to the plants at all. But they're more of a nuisance for us when they're sneaking into homes and buildings. Now, some good news in terms of management. If you do see them congregated in a large area, that's a pretty easy target to hit. And you can actually kill box elder bugs fairly easily with even an insecticidal soap. Or if you mixed up an ounce or two of dish soap with soapy water and sprayed them, you could get rid of a lot of box elder bugs fairly quickly that way.
All right, thanks for that call, Brad. Let's go to Camp Douglas next, where Jim is waiting to get on the air. Jim, go ahead.
Okay, fellas, thank you very much. This winter, while I was snowshoeing, I happened to notice in one of my shoe imprints a dark color, and I scooped it up and held it to my eyes, and I could see something kind of moving, and almost like toner powder. Now, a friend of mine who seems to be a subject matter expert in all of life's areas told me that those were snow fleas. So that was one thing. Another is I've got some ant infestation in my lawn that I would like to take care of. What's a good technique to do that? And then I live next to the woods. Would it be wise for me to have my house spray the outside with pest control to keep insects from coming inside? And I will take your answer offline.
Okay, three questions there. Let's start with the snow fleas. Is there such a thing?
So there is, yeah. And based on the description, it certainly sounds like snow fleas because they had been described as almost like a toner powder. And snow fleas are from this group we call the springtails. And there's a lot of different species, but the species that we call the snow flea can be active in some very cold conditions. And so you'll go out snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and it looks like there's this black graphite powder on the surface of the snow, and if you get down on your hands and knees and look real closely, you notice that some of these black spots are kind of jumping around. So those are snow fleas. They can be fairly common in the state. They really don't hurt anything. They're more scavengers feeding on fungal spores and little things like that, decomposing organic material. So there are such things as snow fleas. They can be pretty common, but harmless, and I think they're pretty fascinating creatures that you can find them out on top of the snow.
Well, let's talk about his ant problem. What would you suggest to control ants in the yard?
Well, so in a situation like this, it would depend a bit on the exact species of ants. And we can get a couple dozen different species of ants that can be fairly common in Wisconsin. Some of them are species that tend to occur more indoors. Some of them are more outdoors. So we'd have to narrow down the exact ant species. If anyone collects ants, they can always send it into the diagnostic lab and we can figure out the exact species. One of the more common types of ants that we see in yard situations are the field ants. And these are the ants that can make very, very large mounds. In some cases, it may be an ant mound the size of a dinner plate. In some cases, the mounds may be a couple feet across. Now, in a situation like that, we can use a liquid insecticide to target the ants and eliminate the colony. It's really a matter of getting that product down into the soil because the queen who kind of runs the colony, she can be a couple feet below ground. So in situations like that, what can be helpful is taking a sturdy dowel rod or metal rod and kind of poking some channels down into the soil in the ant nest so that when we pour in our liquid ant killer insecticide, it will really hit the bulk of the colony.
Mm. All right. And then the third question, he said he had woods around his house. Does he need to spray his house to keep insects out?
in a case like that, it all depends on the individual situation and kind of the history of what goes on in your area. Some folks just happen to live in a certain location where they're dealing with box elder bugs, Asian lady beetles, cluster flies, and all kinds of other creatures sneaking in. And in general, if you're in a wooded area or if you've got a lot of vegetation right along the foundation of your house, that can increase the chances that you've got insects that sneak in. And when we have these types of situations, there's really two main routes we can go. We can either hire a pest control company to spray the exterior of the house, and the thought there is that we prevent the insects from getting in and it'll either kill them before they get in, or some of those products have a little bit of repellent properties too. Now, another option, and both of these could be used in combination, but the best and kind of ultimate long-term solution would be to inspect the outside of the building for cracks and crevices where any insects sneak in. Now, if you are in an old farmhouse or a log cabin style house, that may not be feasible because there's just cracks and gaps all over the place. If you're in a newer or more newly constructed home that is kind of sealed up better, and we can find these locations, and there's not too many of them, we can physically seal those cracks or gaps up with caulk, expanding insulation foam, something along those lines, and that will create a physical barrier to keep the insects out. So there's a couple of options that we could go in that case, but it would kind of depend on the individual situation, the types of insects they're seeing getting indoors, and also the construction of the home.
We had a call from Tony in Minnesota who said he has guinea hens and they've eaten all the ticks in his yard. So maybe we need to start keeping chickens.
Now that I heard of that, I have heard of cases where folks have reported chickens being pretty good at picking off ticks. But, that might take some convincing to have everyone have chickens out in their yard.
Yeah. And in some urban areas, of course, well, you don't get too many ticks there, but they're not, you can't have chickens, or there's a limit on how many you can have. We have an email from John who writes that ticks can crawl out of trash cans. He folds them into tape so they can't go anywhere.
Sure. So that's certainly a good point. If you had a live tick, they could definitely crawl out of a trash can. If you've got a tick that you know for sure is dead, then that wouldn't be an issue for us. If you had a tick that was still potentially alive, wrapping it in tape, duct tape or something like that, or masking or scotch tape to seal it up, or putting it in a Ziploc bag, that will ensure that it's not going to crawl out of the trash can.
What about washing it down the sink?
Well, I suppose in theory that would work as well, just as long as you get enough water that you're going to make sure it's going to make it all the way down into the sewer system.
Okay. All right. Well, we're talking about bugs this hour on the Larry Mueller Show, and P.J. Leash is my guest. He's taking your questions about insects at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. P.J. is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the University of Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. You can also reach us on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and leave a picture of the bug you're interested in on the Facebook page, and we'll have P.J. take a look at it. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back with more of your calls and questions for P.J., on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. John Munson, in for Larry Mueller on the Larry Mueller Show. Today we're talking about bugs with P.J. Leash, the manager of UW-Madison's Insect Diagnostic Lab, and with you at 800-642-1234. Let's start out this segment of the program with Rachel, who is joining us from Milwaukee. Rachel, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. What effect is the white nose syndrome that's in bats and is depleting the population? What kind of an effect is that about mosquitoes and bugs? Are we going to have more bugs because we have fewer bats?
Great question, Rachel. PJ, what do you think? The bat population decrease going to result in more mosquitoes flying around?
I wouldn't think so. The reason for that is it turns out that bats generally don't eat a whole lot of mosquitoes. If you actually captured bats, looked at their gut contents, they seem to feed more on larger nocturnal insects like moths, flying beetles, and the like. And if you think about it from an energy standpoint, they've got to fly around and burn a lot of calories to catch something teeny tiny like a mosquito, so it makes more sense that they'd feed on larger moths and the like. So in terms of white noise affecting mosquitoes, I don't think there would be a connection there necessarily. Now, that does pose an interesting question, because white noise is a serious disease that can affect bats, and if all the bats disappeared, what impact would that have on insects? And I would suspect that bats provide a lot of insect control for us, and so there certainly could be a lot more insects around. Now, if you look at some of the creatures that bats are feeding on, such as moths, our moth populations can vary quite a bit from year to year, because we get a lot of migratory moths, black cutworm and army worms that may migrate up here from southern states in the spring. So it's really hard to tell overall the impact, but I would suspect if white noise became a very significant issue, we wouldn't be benefiting from the pest control services of those animals. And so it wouldn't surprise me if we had more insects around because of it.
All right, Rachel, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Ryan in Janesville. Ryan, thanks for joining us on the Larry Miller Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about insect control and if prescribed burning has any effect on depleting, like, the ticks or any of our pesky insects, and if we can do too much burning, if that can actually harm our insect population as well. And I'll take my question off the air.
Controlled burning for insect control, does it work?
Well, so I haven't seen a whole lot of research published on that particular topic when it comes to something such as ticks. Now, in general, if we've got ticks that are, say, down at the soil surface, and that fire, depending on how hot it gets, and if that gets the soil surface temperatures up high enough, I'd say in theory it could kill ticks, but I'd have to dig in the literature and kind of figure out exactly what temperature the controlled burns would get the soil temperature up to. Now, another thing at play there, even if you did something such as a control burn, and if it did in theory take out ticks in your area, I would expect them to kind of recolonize that burned air fairly quickly through the movement of small rodents and the like. So could it potentially work for ticks or other creatures? I'd say yes, it could potentially, although I think in the long scheme situation, it's not going to have an overall huge impact. Now, for some other insects, controlled burning could potentially have a much more significant impact on those species. There are some insects that rely specifically on certain prairie plants, and so if you are burning too frequently or burning in a way that you're burning everything at once rather than kind of partitioning your area, there is an increased chance that you could affect certain insects that are living in those prairie plants. So when you do controlled burn, there are effects on the insect population in terms of pest control. I don't know how effective it would be, though.
Okay. Thanks for the question. We'll go to Madison next, where Sarah is waiting. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Hey, I'm no entomologist. I'm just one of those crazy insect lovers who escorts all their insects out of the house and says goodbye to them. But as an entomologist, PJ, how do you feel about individuals or companies using pesticides regularly?
Well, so that's an interesting topic that we could talk about for a long time. Now, I think what we need to do when it comes to pest control is really look at each situation separately. If you've got a case where there's a few ants sneaking in from outdoors, you know, there isn't a whole lot of a need to spray a pesticide in a case like that, because we can do things like physically sealing the exterior of a home up or a building up to prevent them from getting in. So I think there's a lot of kind of non-chemical approaches that people can use. Some of them may be a little bit more time-consuming, but certainly those options are out there. Now, for other pests, and again, it all depends on the exact pest, but if we've got something like invasive species, often when we get invasive species in the state or anywhere in the country, we tend to have to rely on pesticides as kind of our first line defense because the natural enemies of those invasive species often are not present. Now, in some cases, we can bring natural enemies over from the native range of an invasive species and bring them under control. But in other cases, if you think about something like the emerald ash borer, we do have biological control programs that are out there. But in terms of the overall impact, they don't seem to be doing a whole lot at this point. Not that they couldn't eventually, but each pest is a little bit different. So for something like emerald ash borer, we do have to rely more on insecticide use, but each pest and each insect is a little bit different.
Sarah, thanks for the question. And PJ, that brings up, you brought up the topic of invasive species. So we've seen infestations of Japanese beetles, Asian lady beetles. You mentioned the emerald ash borer. How are we doing in controlling these invasives and other damaging species?
Well, so invasive species, it's an interesting topic because in terms of new species that I see coming into the state, we might see a few pop up each year. Now, when it comes to invasive species, some may have a fairly minor impact in the state, whereas others may be more of a significant threat. As I mentioned, when we first get invasive species, we often have to rely on insecticides as a management tactic because the natural enemies aren't present. But in other cases, there are these mechanical or kind of physical controls that we can rely on as well. And a good example of this, there's a relatively new invasive species in the state called the viburnum leaf beetle, which has shown up in the northern part of Milwaukee County and some of the nearby surrounding counties. Well, with that species, they lay very distinct egg pits on twigs. And so, in theory, we could go out in winter, inspect our viburnum bushes, because this insect only feeds on viburnums. And if we see those egg pits, we can prune it out so we can control or significantly reduce that insect population without having to use a pesticide. But in terms of invasive species, there are a lot that are certainly out there, and there are a few that pop up over time.
Okay. Thanks for that question. Let's go next to Rita in Arlington. Rita, hello.
Hi. I wondered if you have any idea when the Asian lady beetles reproduce, if it's a fall in October when they, you know, dive into my house by the thousands, or is it in the spring, perhaps, or when?
So with Asian lady beetles, they are going to be reproducing during the warmer months when they are outdoors. In the fall, they're simply sneaking into buildings to look for an overwintering spot. But outside, these guys are actually pretty good predators of certain insects such as aphids, perhaps some small caterpillars and the like. And so if you wandered into something like a soybean field in mid-July and you had soybean aphid present, you're probably going to have some of these Asian lady beetles around feeding on the aphids, but that's also the time of the year that they're reproducing as well.
All right, Rita, thanks for that question. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or look for The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. We're talking about bugs today with PJ Leash and with you. Let's go to Black River Falls for our next call. Carrie is there. Carrie, hello.
Hello. I have a question about mosquitoes. I have a garden pond that has a fountain, and I do what I can in my yard to make sure that I don't have any standing water to get mosquitoes. I try to do my best to get rid of them, but I don't want to get rid of my garden pond. My question is the fountain good enough to keep the water stirring so that the mosquitoes won't lay eggs? Or in the alternative, is there something safe that I could add to the water so that the mosquitoes wouldn't like it?
Sure. So a couple of thoughts on that. And how big of a pond is this?
Oh, it's probably 4 feet by 4 feet.
Okay, so pretty small pond then in that case. In a small pond like that, with that moving water, I would suspect that the mosquitoes aren't going to be going crazy in there just because they tend to like calmer bodies of water. Something, you know, like a bucket filled up with water in a kid's sandbox, something along those lines. So I think that would certainly help. Otherwise, I don't think that's going to be a huge source of mosquitoes in the environment. There are some things that could be added to the water. There is a BT formulation, although I'd have to check on current registrations to see if it's out there. But these are basically a bacterial-based insecticide that mosquito larvae will feed on. But otherwise, I think with that moving water, that's going to end up kind of discouraging mosquitoes from laying eggs in there.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call. Let's try and sneak one more quick call in before we have to go to the news. Kevin in Green Bay, you're up.
Yeah, hi. Question about flies. My wife and I purchased a cabin that was built about 2 years ago way in northern Wisconsin. The first winter we went up there and warmed up the place, we noticed unusual amount of flies in the building, and I was thinking, well, okay, they got in while they were building and went dormant and came alive with the warmth. But then in the fall and even this last spring when it warmed up, unusually warm, I noticed a lot of them congregating on the, you know, the warm exterior side of the cabin on the walls. And I was just wondering if these things are in the ground or where they're coming from.
Okay, PJ, give me about a minute here.
Sure. So my thought is that these may be a creature we call the cluster fly. And cluster flies are actually parasites of earthworms, which are outside in the soil. So we can't do anything about the earthworms. They're just kind of out and about and serving as a source of these cluster flies. But the cluster flies like to sneak indoors in the fall. So again, our two options for a situation like that, seal things up to physically prevent them from getting in, or you could have a pest control company spray the exterior of your home, especially those sunny walls where they like to congregate, to prevent them from getting in.
Yeah, anytime it gets warm, the flies wake up. You can even see them in the wintertime in the house sometimes. So.
Yeah, a case like that, once they get in, we really have to just haul out the vacuum and suck them up. We've kind of lost the battle for that year.
Yeah, or just ignore them. They don't eat much. 800-642-1234. We're going to take a break for the news here at noon. And then when we come back, we'll have more with PJ Leash answering your questions about insects here in Wisconsin. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Today's topic, insects. Do you have any questions or comments for our expert, PJ Leash? He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. It's easy to join the program. Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or find the Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. Do you have an insect you're trying to identify? You can post a picture of it to our Facebook page, and PJ will take a look at it and try to help you out. PJ, glad to have you with us on the Larry Mueller Show today. Appreciate you being here.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
Let's take some more phone calls. Heather is with us in Sparta. Heather, hello.
Hello. Hi. My question is, do you know what insect is small and white and looks like book lice and covers the ground so drastically that it would cover all my laundry on the clothesline, and I would bring it back in to rewash the laundry, and the tub would be full of them.
Wow. PJ, any idea what this these white bugs on her laundry would be?
Well, hard to tell in this case. If you see them again and send some samples in and I can look at them under the microscope, that would certainly help me figure it out. Now, a clue in there that was mentioned being the size of book lice, and book lice are some very, very teeny tiny creatures. There are certainly quite a few small insects outdoors like that, like thrips, and there are spider mites and the like. But to have a large number congregate on fabric and laundry is certainly a little odd. So I'd really have to see a specimen under the microscope to try and narrow down what this may be.
Okay, Heather, you get a sample and send it in, and that'll give PJ a chance to take a better look at it. Thanks for calling today. Let's go to Partyville next. Sarah is on the line with us. Sarah, hello.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. We have a plethora of box elder bugs that are getting into our board and batten home and climbing into the windows, and my vacuuming inside doesn't keep up with them. Any ideas?
Well, so once they're indoors, this is a case where we've kind of lost the battle, but we still haven't lost the war. So once they're in, you kind of just have to deal with them and vacuum them up or get them with paper toweling or catch them and put them back outside. The biggest or best long-term solution we can do is look at the outside of the home, seal things up the best that we can to physically prevent them from getting in. But also, if it's a case where we just can't seal things up completely, having a pest control company make an application to the outside of the home in fall will help prevent the congregating ones from the side of the house from getting in, because it'll kill them when they touch it. The insecticide that's applied to the outside of the house. Another option, which I mentioned a little bit earlier on the show, if you see large numbers of box elder bugs on the outside of your home, one thing you can do is spray them with insecticidal soap. And really the difference between insecticidal soap and dish soap is that the insecticidal soap doesn't have the colors, fragrances, and moisturizers, and it's really designed specifically to kill insects. So you could always try mixing an ounce or two of dish soap with a gallon or so of water and spray it on the box elder bugs on the side of your house. It's simply soap, and yet it can be pretty effective at killing off box elder bugs.
So you'll kill them and make their skin softer. Here's a comment from Connie on Facebook. Connie wants to know she wants info on no-see-ums. What are they, and how can she stop them going through her screens?
So no-see-ums are one of our little tiny biting flies in the state. And in terms of the flies that bite us, like black flies and mosquitoes and horseflies and the like, no-see-ums are basically at the small end of that spectrum. And in a lot of cases, they can be small enough that they can fit through standard window screens. Now, in terms of where they come from, they're often breeding in marshy, somewhat aquatic areas, so we really can't get rid of them at their source. Instead, we have to worry about prevention. Now, if they're fitting through a certain size mesh screen, one thing you could consider, although it would take a fair amount of work, would be to replace your window screens with a finer mesh size. And I've even heard of folks buying essentially mosquito netting, which is super small. Insects just aren't going to make it through it. In replacing the window screens with that, that way you'll have a physical barrier to keep them out. If you're outdoors and you're having issues with biting, some of the repellents can help with them, but also long sleeves and long pants to help prevent bites. And I have to admit, I usually don't react a whole lot to mosquito bites and the like, but when I've bumped into no-see-ums every once in a while, these tiny little flies can really bite you pretty good.
Yeah, they do. They do leave a mark, they're kind of a nuisance. 800-642-1234. We've got about 15 minutes or so left for you to ask your bug questions of PJ Leash, who is the manager of the UW Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. 800-642-1234. If you've been trying to call in and haven't been able to get through, now would be a great time to make a call. Here's a question from EJ in Fond du Lac. EJ wants to know how neonicotinoids work on insects and why they are so devastating to honeybees.
Sure. So neonicotinoids are a class of insecticide that basically function or they affect the nerve cells of the insects. Now, when you look at all the different insecticides out there, and there's many, many different diverse classes of insecticides, they all interact with different insect groups in certain ways. Some may function only against caterpillars and nothing else. Some will function against a broader range. And it turns out that with these neonicotinoids, they work very well against quite a few of our pests, like white grubs and certain beetles, but also sucking insects. So they can control quite a few different insects. Unfortunately, they also happen to be highly toxic to bees if bees are exposed to those products. And so it is a situation with neonicotinoid use that if there are situations where those products are applied to, say, flowering plants and the bees bump into them, that's definitely not a good situation because those bees can die from the exposure. Now, a big question at the moment, real-world exposure. If we are applying a small amount of neonicotinoids to plants, how much gets into pollen and nectar? Are bees picking up enough to have an effect on them? And that's a big question that just hasn't fully been answered because it turns out each plant species interacts slightly differently with these neonicotinoids. And so there's a lot of research that needs to be done at the moment.
Okay, thanks. Great question, EJ. Thanks for sending that in. Let's go next to Sylvia in Evansville. Sylvia, hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. My question is a kind of a mosquito question, and following the woman who called in about the backyard pond, I have a small, unsophisticated backyard pond that I change about every week. Water-wise. And last year, about a 3-inch frog took up residence in the pond, and I was so delighted to see him, I stopped changing the water because I wanted him to stay. And my thinking was that the frog would take care of any developing problem. Is that correct, or was I mistaken?
Well, I'd say potentially. And, I mean, frogs are pretty generalist predators, and they can feed on all kinds of things. It could be aquatic insects, could be worms or other creatures on the land in the nearby area. So in general, will they feed on some insects in that pond? I'd say potentially. Are they going to eat everything in there? That's a really good question. I just don't think they'd be able to eat everything in terms of mosquitoes. But going back to the other call about a little pond fountain, or that pond that had a fountain, when we have something that aerates or bubbles up the water, that makes the females a little reluctant to lay eggs there. So the more agitation that we have, that certainly will help with some insect control in home pond situations.
So even with a small utility tub size or child's pool size, it's not a huge thing.
Okay.
That frog probably couldn't take care of everything.
Well, and it would depend a lot on some other factors, too, because one of the things that can affect insects like mosquitoes, if there's a lot of algae and vegetation in the pond, that's food for those insects. If there's not much in the pond and it's just water, then the insects probably won't be present or not very likely to be present just because they wouldn't have a lot of food to feed on.
And what about the amount of light the pond gets? Does that have any impact?
I wouldn't expect that to impact insects a whole lot. It's more of having a body of water that has organic material, leaves and plant material and algae for insects like mosquitoes and other filter feeders to feed on. But if we've got fairly regular turnover of the water in that pond, that's probably going to be our better long-term insect control, because we're physically removing that material, and by changing the water about once a week, that would help prevent any insect issues such as mosquitoes from building up over time.
Sylvia, thanks for your question. We have a question, an email from Andrew, who wants to know, PJ, if you've heard about a garlic-based product called Mosquito Barrier. It is to be sprayed on lawns and bushes.
Well, so I haven't heard of that particular product called Mosquito Barrier. I have heard of very similar products, though, where it's a garlic oil or a hot chili oil or something like that, with the hopes of preventing mosquitoes or ticks. Or in some cases, some of these products are even used to try and prevent damage from rabbits and deer and the like. Now, in terms of insect prevention with garlic oil and or organic essential oils and things like that, if they do have an effect, it probably is going to tend to be pretty short-lived, because those products that are put out there are going to get broken down by UV light and sunlight and the like. So I wouldn't expect them to work great, and if they did, it would probably be a fairly short-lived phenomenon.
You need a lot of reapplication. But
I'd suspect so.
Garlic repels vampires and mosquitoes. I think there's something there. Let's go to Mark in Cribbets next. Mark, hello.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Is it okay to ask a question about attracting insects instead of getting rid of them?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Well, it's kind of a backstory here. Our house has a covered porch. And in 2012, when my grandkids were visiting from Colorado, we were treated to a magnificent thunderstorm, lots of wind. And my granddaughter went out on our covered porch in the morning and came back in just really excited, because there were moths who had taken shelter just all over everything. We counted, you know, like 20 different, I can't remember just how many, but you know, like a poplar hawk moth. Well, I won't go through them all, but they're coming back this summer. And is there some way, maybe with light, that I might be able to duplicate that? We spent all morning with the bug book and had a great time.
Sure. It's always a blast to go out and have a light trap set up as an entomologist and see all the neat creatures that will show up. Now, one interesting thing that can go on, especially with phenomenon like storms, is all kind of weird insects can get carried on the wind. We will get moth species from the southern states. Every once in a while, we'll get species from Mexico that will get blown up here because of what the jet stream is doing with thunderstorms and the like. So all kinds of weird things can show up after storms. Now, in terms of attracting insects, a general back porch light can be pretty good. If you had a UV light, that would probably be even better. But one thing that entomologists notice, especially folks that specialize in moths, is if you go out to trap moths with light traps, If it's at the time of the month that it is a full moon, you don't tend to see as many moths showing up at the lights just because there's that other light source in the sky you're competing with. So if you watch the calendar and it was a new moon where you basically don't have that competing light source, you can often get more insects to show up. Another trick that moth folks will do, they will mix up a bait. And if you get on the internet and do a Google search for moth bait, you can find all kinds of recipes. It basically boils down to some mushed up bananas and some molasses or brown sugar. We get this sugary source, and a lot of insects, including moths, like that. And so we will put this out on trees or other locations, a pile of firewood outdoors, and you let it sit there for about 12 hours and start to ferment a little bit. Turns out that the moths love that. And so you can use either a light trap or the sugar-based bait and draw a lot of moths in, and you can find some really neat stuff when you do that.
Mark, have fun attracting more moths. Let's go to Brian in Wausau next. Brian, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I've been a certified arborist out in Colorado for the last 8 or 9 years, where in the last 2 years we recently just got the emerald ash borer. So we've been sort of battling with that. But now that I've moved back to the Midwest, I know that out here we've been dealing with it for a much longer period of time, and just wanted to see sort of where we're at in that fight. And also that sort of ties into the conversation earlier with the use of neonicotinoids for battling against that, and that use in this area.
Brian, thanks for the call. Where are we on the emerald ash borer, PJ?
Sure. So in terms of the emerald ash borer, it's been in the state for several years now, and unfortunately it's going to be with us for a very, very long time. If you look at the grander scheme of things, emerald ash borer is basically in that same category as something like Dutch elm disease, where it is going to change the face of our wooded areas and forests for decades to come. So I don't think, unfortunately, that will be able to get rid of it anytime sooner. I think it's going to be with us for a very, very long time. At the moment in the state, we've got just under 40 or so counties quarantined for emerald ash borer. It's essentially the southern half of Wisconsin, up the eastern coast of the state, up towards Door County, but then a few other odd spots, Douglas County up near Superior, and then Oneida County over towards Rhinelander have emerald ash borer. And if you look at those last two examples, Oneida County and Douglas County, it was probably movement of firewood, because this is an insect that can get moved around in recently cut down and infested ash trees. So it's fairly widespread in the state. I'd say numerically speaking, we're over halfway there in terms of all the counties being quarantined, so it's fairly widespread. The map's only going to fill in over time, and we'll be dealing with it for quite a while. Now, in terms of the neonicotinoid use, because we talked a little bit about there's concerns with pollinators and the like, with something like ash trees, neonicotinoids are one of the tools that we can use. There are some other classes of insecticides that are out there. With ash trees, if we don't treat them, almost certainly they're going to die because of emerald ash borer. With something like neonicotinoids, if we look at ash trees as a whole, they're wind pollinated, so they don't seem to be very attractive to insects. And so if you chat with entomologists and experts on the topic, they seem to think that using neonicotinoids using neonics on ash trees against emerald ash borer will probably have fairly minimal risk to pollinators.
Brian, thanks for the call. We have a question from Facebook. Holly writes, wants to know if bald-faced wasps are a more aggressive species of wasp, and how long have they been in Wisconsin?
So bald-faced hornets are a type of really yellow jacket, and there's a lot of very similar species, although bald-faced hornets, they've been around very long time. As far as I know, they are one of our native yellow jacket species. They also happen to be one of the largest ones. And if you see a nest, especially if it's small and the queen is still doing some work, she can be about an inch long or so. And they tend to be whitish and black in color, so they can be fairly common. From my personal experience, I do think they tend to be a little bit more aggressive, but it all depends on the location of the nest. And each yellow jacket nest can have a slightly different temperament. Sometimes you get nests that are very easily kind of riled up. In other cases, they're more reluctant to come out and sting. But with any of those, if you're too close to the nest, they'll come out and let you know.
And one thing I've been noticing more signs in golf courses, we seem to be having more of these of the ground hornets or ground wasps around. Is that just anecdotal, or are we actually seeing more of those?
Well, so when folks say ground wasps, there's actually quite a few different things that could be going on. We could have a situation where we have ground nesting yellow jackets, and those yellow jackets that nest in the ground, they tend to go for pre-existing cavities, such as an old rodent burrow, like a chipmunk, a ground squirrel, something like that, and they'll build their nest below ground. And in a case like that, if you stepped in that nest, they're going to come out and sting you in force, and so that's definitely a tricky situation to deal with. In terms of numbers of those going up, I don't think there's really any major trend. Another thing, just in terms of general awareness, folks are becoming more aware of native bees and the like, and there's all kinds of native bees and also some solitary wasps that nest in the ground. Now, these solitary nesters, because they don't have a big colony to defend, they're really pretty docile. You can go up and really observe them pretty closely, and they won't sting you at all. So it all depends. There's a lot of different creatures that folks might call ground wasps.
Okay. Let's take another call quickly from Karen in Harshaw.
Hi, thanks very much for the call. I love your show. A quick question. What's the forecast for monarchs making up this far? I have a garden that we've let go to milkweed in hopes we'll see some caterpillars. We've seen a few butterflies for the last few years, but no caterpillars. And is there any hope that we'll see some, or should I just dig it all up?
No, I'd say if you've got milkweed planted, I would certainly leave it in the hopes of having monarchs show up. And just from personal experience, the house I was living in 2 years ago, we had an awful lot of milkweed. I just didn't see any monarchs that year, but then last year they showed up. So some years they might just not happen to find your patch of milkweed. In other years they may find it and you get a whole bunch of eggs and caterpillars around. Now, in terms of the overall forecast, we talked a little bit earlier in the show about it. I'm hoping that we're going to have a pretty good monarch year just because their overwintering numbers seem to be up. Hopefully they survive that snowstorm that they had a week ago. It'll be a little while before we see them up here because they've got to migrate back northward, and they'll actually progressively go through a few generations before they get to Wisconsin. So it may be a couple months, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed and hoping that we'll have a pretty good monarch year.
PJ, we're almost out of time. We've seen ticks out already. People have talked about flies and some other things that they've seen. What's the next? What are the next insects we can expect to see as we move into the spring?
Well, depends on what you're doing in your yard. There's a lot of insects that show up on garden plants when we start gardening. We can get some early season aphids and cutworms. On landscape plants, there's scale insects that will actually go through the winter, and you might notice. Some of our more common spring insects, there's an awful lot of caterpillars we see. So usually one of those signs of spring is the tent caterpillars out in black cherry trees in the woods or crab apple trees. So that'll be popping up fairly soon, and then gypsy moth as well falls into that group. So I think we've got a lot of insects that'll be popping up here in the next month and a half.
All right, PJ Leash, thanks for joining us today and giving us the benefit of your expertise about bugs. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
PJ Leash holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the University of Wisconsin, and he's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Jill Nadeau both handled production and on-air production duties. Of course, Dave Potratz did his usual great job on the technical side. Coming up tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, I think this is going to be just a fascinating program. We're going to talk about genealogy and telling you about some great workshops that are coming up on the subject, and we'll take your questions as well. That's coming up tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network.